Negotiations continue today on the possibility of a new coronavirus relief bill. And depending on the time of day, White House and congressional officials were either holding out hope for one last breakthrough or suggesting that a deal may not come together until after Election Day. We'll have more on that story in a minute. This is Washington Today for Wednesday, October 21st. I'm your host, John McArdle. First, some other headlines from around the nation's capital. In Washington, the Justice Department today announced guilty pleas in a more than $8 billion settlement in its investigation into the marketing of painkillers at the heart of America's opioid epidemic. And on the campaign trail, the Trump-Pence campaign held events in North Carolina, Ohio, and New Hampshire today. The Biden campaign sent Senator Kamala Harris to the Tar Heel state of North Carolina, while former President Obama returned to the campaign trail, hosting a drive-in rally for his former vice president in Philadelphia. And from the world of campaign polls, a new survey out today showing Biden running neck and neck with President Donald Trump in the once deep red state of Texas. The new Quinnipiac University survey found Biden and President Trump tied at 47% among likely voters. That's a 5-point polling gain by Biden in the Lone Star State since late September. But we begin today on Capitol Hill, where talks between Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the White House over a coronavirus relief package have remained at an impasse for months. Pelosi said this week that she and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin are on a path to a deal, but a larger relief agreement has met resistance in the GOP-controlled Senate, where some Republicans have rejected a multi-trillion dollar price tag. Here's Speaker Pelosi with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell earlier this afternoon.
Well, I wouldn't even be having these discussions if we didn't think the president had some sway as to whether the Senate would take this legislation up. The election is coming soon. We know that the new Congress and new president are just 2.5 months away. We don't want to wait that long. We want to get something done for the American people as soon as possible. Our bill is over 5 months old. They finally came to the table. And I think it's up to the president to convince people in his own party. But you have to also remember how hard that is, because some of them really don't care to spend any more money to crush the virus, to make our schools safe, to honor our heroes, to put money in the pockets of the American people that is so needed. But I'm optimistic. There will be a bill. It's a question of, is it time to pay the November rent, which is my goal, or is it going to be shortly thereafter and retroactive? So, again, we're in a better place than we have been. And the goal that we had for up until last night was for us to stake out our positions so that it's no more movement, and then, again, come to an agreement. I'm optimistic.
And I know the staff had been working on actual language for the last couple of days, so you've gotten quite a head start, and that's a big lift. But have you gotten anywhere on big obstacles like state and local government, which was so important to you and the Democrats in Congress, and which the president was, railing against, frankly?
Well, a couple of the things that are still outstanding are, of course, the amount that we would spend on state and local, honoring our heroes, our healthcare workers, our first responders, police and fire, food workers, transportation, sanitation, our teachers. The safety of our school and the well-being of our school depends not only on our allocation for COVID-19, but it also depends on how we support state and local government, where most of the money for education comes from. So that affects just almost about everything, health, transportation, and the rest that make our lives function. At that. And then the other bookend to that is liability, where they're, sending essential workers to work. If they don't go, they can't get unemployment insurance. They could be in a dangerous situation, have no recourse if the strong OSHA standards are not kept. Safe schools, safe workplace, these are values. They're not issues. They're not provisions. They're values.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier today. On the other side of Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats blocked a smaller $500 billion Republican-led coronavirus relief proposal. The Republican measure, which failed to clear the 60-vote threshold needed to move forward in the Senate, was nearly identical to the GOP bill that Democrats rejected back in September. Republicans accused Democrats of taking an all-or-nothing approach to coronavirus relief, while Democrats dismissed Wednesday's vote as nothing more than a political stunt. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate Majority Leader and his proposal on the Republican bill.
All week, the Republican majority has scheduled stunt votes on supposed COVID relief bills that are all, in reality, designed to fail. Yesterday, the leader moved to table his own bill so Republicans could vote against tabling it. Let me repeat that, because that's what's happening here. It's hard to believe that this is supposedly the greatest debate chamber in the country or in the world. Leader McConnell moved to table his own bill so Republicans could then vote against tabling it. That's what the Republican majority thinks passes for a serious attempt at COVID relief bill in this Republican Senate when people are suffering so badly. Games, games, when people are suffering. The truth is, the Republican leader needed that vote to fail, because if the Senate actually proceeded to a real bill, it might mess up the timing of the Republican plan to confirm Judge Barrett to the Supreme Court. Now think of that for a moment. The Republican majority sets up a fake vote on COVID relief because, if God forbid, the Senate actually considered a real bill to do something real about this overwhelming COVID crisis, it might delay their Supreme Court nominee that they are rushing through in a process that can only be declared as abusive to the Senate. That's all the American people need to know about priorities on the other side of the aisle. Rush a nominee through whose views are way to the right of the American people and ignore, avoid, play games with getting COVID relief, which is the number one thing the American people want, not a Supreme Court nominee who is so far away from their views. While the country is hurting, while millions of Americans are sick and dying, while workers lose their jobs, businesses close their doors, Republican senators are playing political stunts with vitally needed economic relief. And the games continue today. Once again, the Republican majority will bring up a bill designed to fail, their partisan, emaciated COVID relief bill, so-called COVID relief bill. The bill we're voting on today has already failed in the Senate, didn't get a Democratic vote, and we already know it lacks the votes. And why?
That was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer earlier today. And here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on why he put his bill on the Senate floor.
For more than 7 months now, the American people have been facing what one writer described as a health crisis with an economic crisis strapped to its back. The Senate has stepped up repeatedly on a bipartisan basis to help our nation through this challenge. Today, we have an opportunity to do it once again. The legislation before us is neither Republican nor Democrat, neither of us idea of a perfect bill. I think we're all clear on that, but it would move us past Speaker Pelosi's all-or-nothing obstruction and deliver huge support right now for the most pressing needs of our country. Republicans want to conquer this disease through testing, treatments, and vaccines. Democrats say they agree with us. Republicans want to pour money into safe schools and make sure an entire generation of kids don't fall any further behind. And Democrats say they agree with that. Republicans want to reopen the Paycheck Protection Program so that main streets across America don't turn into COVID ghost towns, so that millions of workers can keep their jobs and keep getting paid. Democrats say they agree with that. For workers who've been laid off, Republicans want to renew the federal supplement to unemployment insurance. Democrats say they agree with that. Republicans want to cement health protections for Americans with pre-existing conditions, including COVID-19 itself. Democrats claim they're all over that issue. And Republicans want to take our nation's college presidents, nonprofit leaders, and employers at their word when they say they need common sense protection so that legal uncertainty does not block their reopening.
That was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier today. Here's what Politico wrote today about the state of negotiations. Quote, with November 3rd fast approaching, a coronavirus relief deal coming together before the election is looking increasingly unlikely. While Secretary Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi are pressing forward with talks on a broader package, most Senate Republicans are not expected to support the $1.8 trillion price tag that the White House is proposing. And Mitch McConnell told members at a lunch Tuesday that he discouraged the White House from a large stimulus deal ahead of the election that would further divide the GOP caucus. Back at the White House, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows spoke about where the White House stands. Again, according to Politico, quote, President Donald Trump is betting that he can persuade the GOP caucus to go along with the stimulus package if Pelosi and Mnuchin manage to reach an agreement, end quote. And Meadows said Wednesday morning on Fox Business that he remains optimistic about reaching a deal in the next 48 hours, and he planned to speak with Senate Republicans about supporting it. He added that the biggest issue remains state and local aid. You can read that entire article at Politico.com. Here's Chief of Staff Mark Meadows from earlier today.
Yeah, I've talked to Leader McConnell and his staff on a regular basis. We've had a number of discussions with them and other Republican senators. And so as it relates to a particular vote on the Senate floor, I'm going to leave that up to him. But I am optimistic that if we get a bipartisan agreement that comes out of the discussions that Secretary Mnuchin and Speaker Pelosi are having directly, actually, the discussions that Secretary Mnuchin and I have had over the last several days, talking to him late yesterday, we'll be talking again here shortly. I've got to talk to some of Speaker Pelosi's team as well as Chairman Shelby on a number of issues. We're down now to looking at some of the language in some of the provisions to make sure that there are not poison pills there. And if we can get that right, then hopefully the numbers will get right. Secretary Mnuchin and the President have actually moved more towards Nancy Pelosi in a spirit of trying to provide real relief for the American people. I haven't seen the commensurate move by Speaker Pelosi coming the other way. And so if there's a deal to be done, it's there for her to do. And if it doesn't get done, the blame will be totally on Speaker Pelosi's shoulders. And I would say more on her shoulders than even some of the rank-and-file Democrats in the House who believe that the offer that the president has made is generous and spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry to step on your question there. I don't normally get into, the details of discussions I have with Leader McConnell. I can tell you that I'm having discussions with him on a regular basis. And while he has a number of members that will go everywhere from not wanting another dollar to go out to other members who support the president's proposal, he's going to have to manage that. There was no warning from Leader McConnell. Actually, my conversations with the leader have been very robust and continue on to this to this date where we're looking at the options. Leader McConnell and the Senate Republicans have the same priority that the president has, and that's to make sure that we get enough help to those that are hurting as quickly as possible.
That was Chief of Staff Mark Meadows earlier today. At the Department of Justice, Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen today held a press conference about guilty pleas and a multi-billion-dollar settlement reached between the government and the pharmaceutical company Purdue Pharma in its investigation into the marketing of highly addictive opioid painkillers. We'll have more on that investigation in a minute, but first, here's the Deputy Attorney General at the Justice Department with that announcement today.
The global settlement announced today involves the company pleading guilty to three felony counts for defrauding the United States and violating the anti-kickback statute from 2009 to 2017. In addition to the company having agreed to plead guilty to these three felony counts, the company has agreed to a $3.544 billion criminal fine and a $2 billion criminal forfeiture amount. Further, on top of those, to resolve its civil liability, Purdue Pharma has agreed to $2.8 billion in damages to the United States. Now, the company's in bankruptcy, so the corporate resolution is subject to the bankruptcy court's approval. If it's approved, this will be a corporate settlement in total of more than $8.3 billion. Additionally, members of the Sackler family have agreed to pay $225 million in a civil settlement that will provide civil releases only.
The Justice Department today announced guilty pleas in a multi-billion-dollar settlement in its investigation into the marketing of painkillers at the heart of America's opioid crisis. Washington Post Business of Healthcare reporter Chris Rolland joins us now with the story. Chris Rolland, remind us first who Purdue Pharma is and why they are under federal investigation.
So Purdue Pharma is a pharmaceutical company based in Connecticut, and their main product, representing 90% of their sales for the last two decades, was OxyContin, the highly addictive time-release opioid that they introduced to the market in 1996, and through an aggressive marketing campaign and some novel strategies on how to push it out into the communities, help fuel America's opioid addiction epidemic. And they've been under investigation really since the early 2000s, resulting in, you know, a number of different actions by governments, citizens, families of people who have died from addiction, state attorneys general investigations, lawsuits. And so a lot of that stuff is now coming to a head.
What did they plead guilty to today?
So the company, not executives, so the corporation pleaded guilty to three felony counts today of False Claims Act and improper marketing type charges, which allege that the company knew that it was promoting products that were dangerous and that were being used improperly by its customers, or being sold by doctors or given by doctors to likely addicts. They knew that they were giving the drug distributing the drug to doctors who were prescribing enormous amounts of the drug, and otherwise either knew or should have known that the drug was being used for illegal purposes and was contributing to a healthcare epidemic in the United States. So that's the criminal aspect. Then there's as you mentioned, there's a very large civil penalty levied against the company of $8.3 billion. Actually, it's criminal and civil combined. But the company doesn't have really any money to speak of. It's all tied up in bankruptcy, and its income is very low now. And so there's not really a chance that the government is going to see its share of that money. And in fact, the government's saying that that money can, you know, it could go into whatever bankruptcy proceedings are happening. Purdue Pharma has filed for bankruptcy in New York, in a federal court in New York. Then the other aspect to today's settlement is the Sackler family. So the Sackler family, which bought the company in 1952 and introduced OxyContin, in 1996, it's a privately held company. They were on the board of directors, and they agreed to a civil penalty, a civil settlement of $225 million, which where they don't admit any criminal or civil liability. But the government did attach their allegations to the settlement. And those say that they, you know, the Sacklers, even after the company had pleaded guilty in 2007 to another set of charges for inappropriate marketing, that the Sackler family, as the board, all its individual members, put in tremendous pressure on the company, the executives, to come up with a new marketing plan to extract more sales from OxyContin, which again led to another cycle and pattern of inappropriate prescribing, which caused people to become addicted, you know, even more to the drug. By that time, OxyContin was an abuse deterrent formulation, so you couldn't crush it up and inject it as easily as you could in the past. But they were promoting the very high-strength, time-release OxyContin, and people were continuing to abuse it. and continuing to die from overdoses and from it. That's for the last decade. That's from 2007 till just 2018.
At this point, does it look like anybody's going to eventually go to jail as a result of those issues and the opioid crisis and everything you just talked about?
No, that doesn't look like any. At least as of now, it doesn't look like anybody's going to go to jail. The biggest issue right now is whether or not the Sacklers are going to get away with keeping around, you know, as much as $11 billion of cash that they pulled out of the company after 2007. So far they've agreed, and as part of the company's bankruptcy settlement, to put in $3 billion. But state attorney generals, counties, cities all say that's totally insufficient given what they spirited out of the company after 2007. So the government today released some new emails that where you can see that the, you know, there was actually, you know, in 2007, the family was worried about their exposure to lawsuits and that they probably needed to figure out a way to start extracting cash out of the company and getting into their own pockets. A lot of that money did end up in overseas trusts and a very complicated set of companies and LLCs. And so, you know, state's attorney generals have spent the last few years trying to sort all that out.
And I guess in our final minute, what does this mean for future criminal charges? And what else is Purdue Pharma facing on the civil front?
So, very interestingly, the government did say today that nothing that happened precludes potential criminal charges being brought against executives or the Sacklers individually in the future. So, you know, those investigations could be ongoing. There certainly seemed to be some timing here where the government seemed to be motivated to have a settlement before the election. I mean, they've been investigating this for literally years. So, you know, coming 2 weeks before the election makes you wonder, you know, if the Sacklers were able to extract a pretty, you know, a somewhat lenient deal given the extent of the allegations against them because of the desire by the Trump administration to get this deal done before the election. So, you know, if the investigations continue after this, which is not precluded by the settlement, there could be some criminal and civil penalties or you know, allegations brought by the government in the future as well. But I think what it also has a pretty significant bearing on the bankruptcy proceedings, because the bankruptcy judge now will be looking at all these things that are happening and say, okay, this was a big chunk of unfinished business that was hanging out there, and now we know what the government's position is. We know what the settlements are going to be. We know that the Sacklers are going to be paying another $225 million in addition to their $3 billion that they're putting into the bankruptcy. So, you know, so that kind of all adds up to, you know, I think the main thrust of the litigation will be hammered out in bankruptcy court. In addition to what's happening in bankruptcy court, there's almost 3,000 lawsuits brought by states, counties, and cities, and they've all been consolidated in the federal litigation in Cleveland, Ohio. And that all that litigation is kind of hanging on what happens with the bankruptcy proceedings of Purdue Pharma in White Plains, New York. So I would say, you know, all roads now lead to bankruptcy court and see what happens there.
Covering the business of healthcare for The Washington Post, it's Chris Rolland. Appreciate your time this afternoon.
Hey, sure thing. No problem.
Welcome back to Washington Today. I'm your host, John McCardle. We're 13 days out from Election Day, and the candidates are entering the final stretch. Former Vice President Joe Biden was off the trail today, preparing for tomorrow's debate in Nashville. Meanwhile, President Trump is focusing on North Carolina today, just hours after Vice Presidential candidate Kamala Harris hit the state earlier today. And we'll have more on the battle for the Tar Heel State in a moment. But also earlier today, Vice President Mike Pence delivered remarks at a campaign rally in New Hampshire. He spoke about the Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett and the upcoming confirmation vote for her. Here's a portion of those remarks.
When we think of the rule of law, we think of last month. We paused as a nation to rightly honor the life and service of the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But when the memorials were over, President Trump fulfilled his constitutional duty and he nominated a remarkable, brilliant, principled, conservative woman who loves the Constitution to the Supreme Court of the United States. He nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Isn't she great? Now, the President and I are calling on Democrats to give Judge Barrett a respectful and dignified confirmation. But we have reason to be concerned. And you all remember a couple years ago, during her last confirmation to the Court of Appeals, the leading Democrat on the Judiciary Committee actually criticized Judge Barrett's Catholic faith. She said it was a concern, saying, and I quote, "The dogma lives loudly within you." And Hollywood elites have already begun to criticize Judge Barrett's faith. Well, I got news for the Democrats and their friends in Hollywood. That dogma lives loudly in me. That dogma lives loudly in you. And the freedom to live, to work, to worship according to the dictates of our faith lives loudly in the Constitution of the United States of America.
That was Vice President Mike Pence earlier today in New Hampshire. In Asheville, North Carolina today, Senator Kamala Harris delivered remarks about the coronavirus and aid to Americans. Here are some of her remarks.
13 days to go. 13 days to go. And we cannot spare a minute, sister and brothers. We cannot spare a minute in terms of everything that I know everyone here and around our country is prepared to do, as Joe Biden says, to fight for the soul of our nation. And that's really what's going on, right? It's about fighting for the soul of our nation. It's about knowing we deserve more and we are better than this. And there's so much that happened even before COVID struck. But in many ways, I've thought of this pandemic as being an accelerator, in that it has highlighted what was wrong before and it has made it worse, right? And so let's think about it in the context of what has been going on in terms of public health, especially during this virus. And we can't overlook the fact that on January 28th, Donald Trump and Mike Pence were informed about the nature of COVID-19, this virus. They were informed. 5 times more likely to kill people than the flu. Informed it could harm children. Informed it is airborne. Can you imagine what the families of Asheville, what the families of North Carolina could have done with that information on that date? To prepare, be it to stock up on toilet paper or to plan, because we know that the vast majority of Americans don't have more than $1,000 in savings. And what folks might have done to prepare, knowing that it's predictable that they may not be able to go to work for a while. And sadly, we still have so many workers in America who don't have paid sick leave and paid family leave. But he didn't tell us.
With North Carolina's 15 electoral votes up for grabs on November 3rd, both presidential campaigns made trips to the Tar Heel State today. For more on those visits, we're joined by Brian Gordon, North Carolina statewide reporter for the USA Today Network. Brian Gordon, where did the campaigns head today and why?
So Kamala Harris made a visit to Asheville in the western part of the state today. And President Trump is holding a rally in Gastonia, a little closer to the central of the state tonight. And at this point, a lot of the convincing of voters is already done. And really, the aim seems to be to energize the base by going to Asheville for Kamala Harris is definitely a blue dot in the western part of the state. And Gastonia has a traditionally pretty heavy conservative population. And so I think both candidates and both campaigns are really looking at getting out the vote at this point.
In terms of getting out the vote, a story by you in the Fayetteville Observer, is Biden bringing black voters back to the polls? Explain what you found.
Just the stat that kind of led me into the story was a political scientist here calculated that 170,000 black Democrats in North Carolina voted in 2012 for President Obama's second term, but stayed home in 2016. And in a swing state that's considered a toss-up by a lot of the pollsters, really any demographic can be the difference. And 170,000 black Democrats who reliably vote for Democrats, that really could make the difference. And with a lot of things in 2020, it's kind of hard to make comparisons to other years, is what a lot of the professors and political experts, consultants I've spoken to say. One equated the voting turnout this year to a watermelon, where in 2016 it was more like a kiwi. The numbers have just been astronomical for early voting. And so parsing through how different demographics are doing, it can be a bit challenging. But overall, in North Carolina, 30% of voters have already cast ballots. And voting turnout among the black voters, black registered voters, is about 31%, which is about halfway to the point in 2016, with still 2 weeks before Election Day. So people are optimistic that, especially among the black black residents, that their turnout is going to be closer to 2012 than 2016. And that could, really kind of make the difference in the state.
When you say make the difference, what did Hillary Clinton lose North Carolina by in 2016? Was it about that 170,000 number?
Yeah, a little bit more, a little over 200,000. But this year, if Biden can get those votes and then pick up a few others, or there are discontented Trump voters who are either going to vote for Biden or stay home, it's a little bit of a trick with journalism, is that we say we could pick really any demographic in North Carolina and that could be the difference. But looking at the energy that members of the black community who I spoke with for the story, they're saying anecdotally that they're just feeling more energy, that 2016, still 90% of black voters went for Hillary Clinton, but just the turnout was about 9% lower than it had been in 2012. And this year they're saying they're feeling and they're seeing some remnants or some resemblance to 2012, more than 4 years ago.
So what is that pitch to black voters specifically? What is the Biden campaign trying to do what the Clinton campaign in 2016 did not?
I wasn't covering the state in 2016, so I won't speak as much about what Hillary didn't do or Ms. Clinton didn't do. But for the Biden campaign, like the Trump campaign, they're both stressing economics. I think that's kind of a pretty universal pitch for all voters. It's the economy, stupid, as the old refrain went. But I think specifically for the Biden campaign, highlighting structural racism in education, healthcare, housing, really criticizing President Trump's response and what's perceived as a lack of condemnation towards white supremacists. And black voters who I spoke to for the story say that the summer of social justice campaigns and Black Lives Matter has pushed people to the polls. How much of that is Joe Biden specifically with his message, or maybe his association with President Obama, drawing people in, or how much of it is President Trump's drawing people against him? That's kind of hard to say, but those are kind of the messages that are the campaigns are trying to bring up.
The story again in the Fayetteville Observer, the headline is Biden bringing black voters back to the polls. The answer could decide who wins North Carolina. Brian Gordon, before you go, what's the latest on that Senate race down there that could decide control of the Senate between Tom Tillis and Cal Cunningham?
So the polls have tightened in the latest round. So 2 weeks ago is when the story broke that Cal Cunningham, the Democratic challenger to Tom Tillis, the sitting senator, had a sexting affair. And there is a lot of speculation. Would this impact the polls? Would it not? And the first round of polling showed that the affair didn't hurt Cunningham. He maintained a small but clear lead that he has had for much of the campaign, around 5 or 6%. But the most recent polls show a tightening of the race. And so that could be that the scandal, which the Tillis campaign has been highlighting in commercials and super PACs have been highlighting commercials, maybe that's starting to bake in with voters, or maybe there are broader issues at play. With a Senate race like this that could determine national implications, it's hard to know exactly what's motivating voters, whether they're motivated by individual characters' moral conduct, whether they're motivated about what these two potentials, the sitting senator and the potential future senator, would do for the state specifically, or maybe they're not really thinking about the state at all, and they're really looking at the broad picture, thinking about the Supreme Court, and basing their vote on that.
Covering the political campaigns across the Tar Heel State for the USA Today Network, it's Brian Gordon. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're listening to Washington Today. Senate Republicans spoke with reporters this afternoon about the proposed constitutional amendment to limit the number of Supreme Court justices to 9. The senators talked about the need to protect the Supreme Court amid fears that Democrats may pack it with more liberal justices. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina.
Here's the deal. This was done a year and a half ago. I can't think of a more destabilizing event for America than change the number of judges on the Supreme Court every election cycle, because it becomes a winner-take-all for the court. The traditional debate has been who fills vacancies, liberal, conservative. It's never been about how many will you have, and you'll eventually destroy the judiciary as we know it. We're screwed up enough on our side of the constitutional aisle where we're fighting with each other constantly. So I just want to urge all of my colleagues to support Senator Rubio's efforts to solidify that we're sticking with 9. 9 has served us well. I know people are mad. Judges are very emotional. But the thing I can tell you about the court is you never know. There are a lot of criticism about Roberts on our side. That just comes with life tenure. My belief is that life tenure is a good thing. My belief that 9 has served the nation well. And if we go down the road that they're talking about, that will destroy the independence of the judiciary.
That was Senator Lindsey Graham earlier today at the Capitol. Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, also mentioned that there could be a vote on the amendment early next week. And on CNN earlier today, Congressman Jim Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, spoke about his worries that the Supreme Court is already packed. Congressman Clyburn went on to compare the current makeup of the court to that of the mid and late 19th century. Here are his remarks from earlier today on CNN.
Well, I think the Supreme Court is being packed now.
Is that a good idea?
Well, adding justices, I think we need to unpack the Supreme Court. There needs to be balance in the Supreme Court. You know, I know what the Supreme Court was like during the Dred Scott decision. I know what the Supreme Court was like during Plessy versus Ferguson. And I think that this court that we see developing now is a throwback to Plessy versus Ferguson. Even Dred Scott.
You do? You think it goes that?
Absolutely, I do believe that. I have said before, and I believe very strongly, that the Shelby v. Holder decision that got rid of the Voting Rights Act was the worst decision of the Supreme Court since Dred Scott. I said that. I believe that very strongly because I know what the vote does for people of color. And I know what happened here in South Carolina and other states immediately after that decision when all of these onerous things were done to people's voting rights. That's what's going on right now. A massive suppress the vote effort made possible by Holder or Shelby v. Holder would not happen but for that Supreme Court decision.
That was Congressman Jim Clyburn earlier today on CNN. And finally today, the Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing focusing on the future of passenger and freight rail in America. According to Forbes magazine, quote, Amtrak CEO William Flynn asked the Senate to provide emergency funding to help the transportation company operate next year as ridership continues to decline, end quote. Some forecasts predict passenger ridership to remain 70% below pre-COVID levels into 2021. Here's Senator Jerry Moran, Republican of Kansas, speaking with Amtrak CEO William Flynn earlier today.
I suppose where we are now is, how is long-distance passenger rail service defined? When you say it's a priority, it's a responsibility, it's an obligation, how is it defined, particularly in the days of COVID, when passengers are fewer? How do we make certain that we're fulfilling, I hope this is your attitude, how do we make certain we're fulfilling that obligation, requirement, that mission that Amtrak has?
Those are the, that's the discussion we've been having here this morning, and the discussion that I presented in my testimony. The levels of ridership have fallen off so dramatically that running a daily service right now without some financial assistance through supplemental funding will essentially reduce the company to a very, very precarious state. It would require taking funds that have been allocated for capital projects that would otherwise go across our network. It would require transfers from the NEC to the national network, which is not provided for under current legislation. It's specifically prohibited, and it's the kind of management challenge. It is the management challenge that we have, and it underscores the decisions we have to make to balance the equities that we're required to meet.
Mr. Flynn, I'm sorry I didn't hear your opening statement, although I have your written statement in front of me. I'm chairing a committee myself this morning that meets at the same time as this committee, but your indication is that because that obligation is so real, so that it exists, that should things continue to be dire in regard to passenger ridership, Amtrak would take additional steps to keep passenger rail service long distance running, but they're not good options, but there are options that you, because of that obligation, would have to pursue.
There aren't any really good options. Thank you, Senator. There aren't any good options.
Well, you mentioned capital improvements.
Pardon me?
You mentioned capital.
Well, some of the funds that we have are specifically directed to specific capital projects. So in terms of our cash balance, we don't have the freedom to put the cash balance anywhere we want because there's direction that exists.
And maybe the point you were making is you would need Congress to authorize that transfer of money from capital improvements to maintaining long-distance passenger service?
I wouldn't recommend it, though. Congress may direct
it,
but it's not something we'd recommend.
That was Amtrak CEO William Flynn earlier today at that Senate Commerce Committee hearing on passenger and freight rail. You can find the entire hearing on our website at cspan.org. Well, if you've missed any part of this program, you can find it on the free C-SPAN radio app or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for joining us today on Washington Today. I'm John McArdle. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.